From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, during this political convention month, we listen back to presidential speeches from earlier decades. We'll talk with Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. They compiled a CD box set of presidential speeches dating back as far as 1908. Also, the story of a singer who found his voice by impersonating Tom Jones. And film critic Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews She's the One. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton today will announce measures aimed at cracking down on cigarette smoking amongst teenagers. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
This afternoon, the president will cap a week of daily actions on popular political issues with an announcement that his administration is moving to restrict teenage tobacco use. New federal regulations would officially declare nicotine as an addictive drug and cigarettes as a drug delivery device. The FDA would prohibit cigarette advertising aimed at young people, removing vending machines from places teenagers frequent, and require that all cigarette purchases be made in face-to-face sales. The president's pollsters say curbing smoking is very popular among independent voters and worried suburban parents who welcome some government assistance in raising their kids. Republicans attacked the president's announcement as a cynical election year gimmick. They say it's time to distract attention from an embarrassing report on teenage use of illegal drugs, which has doubled during the Clinton administration. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Commerce Department says orders to factories for durable goods were up 1.6% in July. That's the second gain in 3 months. The demand was higher in all major categories except volatile transportation, which was unchanged. Continued gains could mean increased production and more jobs. Dr. Jack Kevorkian has helped two more people to commit suicide. Roger Adams of member station WDET reports from Detroit.
Kevorkian brought the body of 66-year-old Pat DeGonji to a hospital emergency room last night. He was a retired history teacher from Brooklyn, New York. Just 8 hours earlier, Kevorkian had taken the body of 40-year-old Patricia Smith of Missouri to the same hospital. DeGonji and Smith both suffered from multiple sclerosis. After leaving DeGonji's body with hospital staff last night, Kevorkian scuffled with police officers trying to question him about the death. He was arrested on a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge and briefly jailed. The deaths yesterday bring the total number of assisted suicides involving Kevorkian to 38 since 1990. Autopsies are scheduled for later today on DeGonji and Smith. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Adams in Detroit.
Weather forecasters say Hurricane Dolly is moving inland near Tampico, Mexico. The storm is already losing some of its strength as the center makes landfall. Sustained winds have dropped to 75 miles per hour. Dolly is expected to go on weakening as it moves into Mexico and into a mountainous region. Meanwhile, far out in the Atlantic, Tropical Storm Edward is on the verge of becoming a hurricane. That storm has sustained winds of 70 miles per hour. Edward is centered about 1,500 miles east of the Lesser Antilles. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 23 points at 5,710. This is NPR. Doctors in India report Mother Teresa's condition has worsened. Her heart stopped beating for a moment yesterday, but doctors say they revived her. The 85-year-old Roman Catholic nun is running a fever and has had a relapse of malaria. She remains on a respirator. She has a history of both heart problems and malaria. The Nobel Peace Prize winner was admitted to a hospital last Tuesday. Taiwanese President Lee Teng-hui responded today to China's call for new unification talks. President Lee says as long as China accepts that Taiwan is sovereign and has its own foreign ties, Taiwan is willing to speak. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
The fact that China and Taiwan are even talking about resuming political dialogue is a sign that the tensions of last March, when China conducted war games in the Taiwan Straits, are easing. But while Taiwanese President Li Donghui says China and Taiwan should talk, He said today that China should first recognize that Taiwan is de facto a sovereign entity. As such, he told the Nationalist Party Congress, Taiwan will continue to try to expand its own international ties to counterbalance China's attempts to keep Taiwan isolated. Case in point, the visit to Ukraine this week by Taiwan's vice president. Few things Taiwan does irritate China more. It sees Taiwan as a renegade province which should have no foreign ties of its own. I'm Mary Kay Magstud in Beijing.
There is no heavy fighting today in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. The city is experiencing the latest ceasefire in the rebellion war. The truce was brokered by Russian security chief Alexander Lebed, but President Boris Yeltsin says he's not completely satisfied with Lebed's work. There's no indication that the ceasefire will hold. Russian troops are supposed to pull out of Grozny, but they say they've been given no orders to do so. Chechen rebels are doubtful Russia will act. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, with the Republican convention behind us and the Democratic convention just ahead, we're going to listen back to past presidents and compare their oratory styles and their messages. The speeches we'll hear come from a box set of CDs collecting historic presidential speeches from 1908 to 1993. The presidential swearing-in ceremony is usually celebratory, but Gerald Ford nearly broke up after he was sworn in following Richard Nixon's resignation in the wake of Watergate.
Before closing, I ask again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself. May God bless and comfort his wonderful wife and daughters, whose love and loyalty will forever be a shining legacy to all who bear the lonely burdens of the White House. I can only guess at those burdens, although I have witnessed at close hand the tragedies that befell three presidents and the lesser trials of others.
The Presidential Speeches CD box set is a co-production of the Library of Congress and Rhino Records. After it was released last year, I spoke with Sam Brolofsky and Cooper Graham, who compiled the collection. They're both with the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew how to use radio with his fireside chats. I asked Sam Brolofsky the significance of FDR's radio addresses.
Well, I think one significance is that Roosevelt took office during an incredible crisis, not just the Great Depression, which was, you know, become so important in 1933 when he took office, in March of 1933, but at that time also, as soon as he took office, he took action on the banks of the United States. And this speech is made within 2 weeks of him taking office, as I recall.
So this would be his very first fireside chat.
It was probably his very first public address after his inaugural address. So it's significant that here he went directly to the people. He didn't give a speech to Congress. He didn't go to a major organization. He went directly to the people. And this was a very significant thing that Roosevelt did by going to the people so often through radio. It sort of usurped machine politics at the time. One traces the descendancy of machine politics to Franklin Roosevelt and the fact that he skips over them and goes directly to the people over the radio through what were called intimate chats.
So before we hear this 1933 fireside chat, Roosevelt's first fireside chat, tell us what the crisis is that he's addressing so we can hear this in context.
There was a depression, and the depression had gotten worse and worse to the point where a lot of banks were having all their money pulled by anxious depositors who felt that all the banks were going to fail. Of course, any bank has far more deposits in it than it has cash on hand, so the banks would have... there would have been a run on all the banks in the United States, and there would have been complete financial panic. Roosevelt has the reputation of being a liberal, but at that point I think the business community was sufficiently frightened that they were also asking that he take any steps that were necessary to try to avert this crisis. I don't think most people now can imagine how serious it was. So there was an awful lot riding on this speech to try to persuade Americans not to pull their money out of the banks.
So let's hear it. This is Franklin Roosevelt, his first fireside chat, 1933.
First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds, in commercial paper, in mortgages, and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning round. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? Because of undermined confidence on the part of the public, there was a general rush by a large portion of our population to turn bank deposits into currency or gold. A rush so great that the soundest banks couldn't get enough currency to meet the demand. The reason for this was that on the spur of the moment, it was of course impossible to sell perfectly sound assets of a bank and convert them into cash except at panic prices far below their real value.
Franklin Roosevelt, recorded in 1933, his first fireside chat. What was the public reaction to that first chat?
It was very, very favorable. Not, of course, the expected panic didn't take place, which is negative evidence, but seemed to be proof that a lot of people listened to the speech and took the president's words to heart. Also, there was an incredible amount of mail. The White House received something like four or five times the mail it had received after a speech by the previous administrations, to the point where they had to hire extra people to deal with it. So the response to Roosevelt's speech was overwhelming. One commentator says that within the space of this speech, capitalism was saved. Maybe it was.
On this new CD box set, you've included a speech by President Truman, recorded in 1948 upon accepting the Democratic nomination for president. Why did you choose this speech from Truman?
Going into this campaign, Truman was very much the underdog. Most people didn't think he had much of a chance. And his speaking style was generally considered to be terrible. It was a very flat, pronounced Missouri accent, and people had been talking to him for years about changing his style, trying to make his sentence shorter and punchier. And if he really could speak to an audience the way he could speak to friends of his at a poker game, he would be a wonderful speaker. And for some reason, at 2 o'clock in the morning of his acceptance speech of the Democratic candidate in 48, he seemed to take their advice to heart, because you hear Truman at his best in his speech.
Let's hear an excerpt of this speech, Harry Truman from 1948, at the Democratic National Convention. He's accepting the nomination for president.
Confidence and security have been brought to the American people by the Democratic Party. Farm income has increased from less than $2.5 billion in 1933 to more than $18 billion in 1947. Never in the world were the farmers of any republic or any kingdom or any other country as prosperous as the farmers of the United States. And if they don't do their duty by the Democratic Party, they're the most ungrateful people in the world. Wages and salaries in this country have increased from $29 billion in 1933 to more than $128 billion in 1947. That's labor. And labor never had but one friend in politics, and that was the Democratic Party and Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I'll say to labor just what I've said to the farmers. They are the most ungrateful people in the world if they pass the Democratic Party by this year.
Harry Truman accepting the Democratic presidential nomination in 1948. I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but it seems to me a presidential candidate would never call voters ungrateful. I mean, you don't say anything that could alienate any voters. What do you think?
I certainly agree with you. On the other hand, as Cooper said, this was 2 a.m. in the morning, so I'm not sure how many voters heard this address.
But there was also a drifting away, both by labor and by some of the farmers in 48, and I think would not be considered to be necessarily a judicious thing to do, but it may have reminded them exactly who their friends were, and I think I would have been somewhat impressed by it if I'd been a union man or a farmer in 48.
We'll talk more about presidential speeches after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress, they produced a CD box set of presidential speeches. Let's jump ahead to 1969. You've included an address by President Nixon to the nation on the war in Vietnam. Why did you include this speech?
Well, this is the silent majority speech. In making the selections, we decided that we would contact the presidents or their staffs or families to see what speech they would like to be represented by. Initially, this was a contact to say, gee, we're going to preserve a speech in a special new process with some experiments we're doing at the Library of Congress. What speech would you like to be assured was preserved for posterity? And all of the presidents or their families from Mrs. Onassis on responded, but the Nixon office did not respond to Cooper.
Therefore, we decided to go with a speech that President Nixon admired, and he had mentioned very favorably in the arena. That's the book, one of the books. He had mentioned his silent majority speech several times as being one of his best, and also he felt one that changed public opinion in the United States, so we decided to go along with it. And of course, the silent majority is one of the best-known sort of catchwords of the period. Also, since it deals with Vietnam, we thought it was a topical, not a topical speech, but a speech that dealt with that that epoch in American history. So for these reasons, we decided to go with a silent majority speech. Also, it was evidently partly the speech that some commentators have said marked out a new group in the United States, some Democrat, some Republican, that might vote for Republicans in the future. And this, in fact, seems to have been a pretty accurate prediction.
Okay, Richard Nixon, recorded in 1969.
I have chosen a plan for peace. I believe it will succeed. If it does not succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. Or if it does succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. If it does not succeed, anything I say then won't matter. I know it may not be fashionable to speak of patriotism or national destiny these days, but I feel it is appropriate to do so on this occasion. 200 years ago, this nation was weak and poor. But even then, America was the hope of millions in the world. Today, we have become the strongest and richest nation in the world. And the wheel of destiny has turned so that any hope the world has for the survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamina and the courage to meet the challenge of free world leadership. Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris. Let us be united for peace. Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans can do that.
President Nixon's silent majority address, recorded in 1969 on the war in Vietnam. You know, it's interesting. I mean, he didn't reprise the words silent majority a lot during that address. What do you think it was about those words that caught on?
I think that sort of that, I don't know, I guess the polarizing aspect of the speech is what made it catch on by dividing the public into camps. It's important to remember that the context of this speech is all these mass demonstrations going on outside the White House at the time. So by calling someone silent, you're placing them in comparison to these dirty hippies who were, you know, burning flags and having these sort of, in many cases, you know, unseemly protests going on in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial.
Now let's jump ahead to President Clinton. You've chosen a speech from 1993, his remarks to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ. What is this speech about, and what do you think it shows about Clinton's style of speechmaking?
Well, this speech is about race in the United States and class and economic policy in the United States. I think it was a very successful speech for him, at least in its immediate response. It was to an African-American audience in Memphis. I think that Clinton has a very good reputation for one-on-one speaking. He's a very charismatic speaker privately. And I don't think that his reputation is as good as a public speaker, but I think he tries to be somewhat intimate, if that's a word you can be, with the hundreds or thousands listening to this speech.
Okay, this is President Clinton, an excerpt of a speech to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ, 1993.
If Martin Luther King, who said, like Moses, I am on the mountaintop and I can see the promised land, but I'm not going to be able to get there with you, but we will get there. If he were to reappear by my side today and give us a report card on the last 25 years, what would he say? Say, you did a good job, he would say, voting and electing people who formerly were not electable because of the color of their skin. You have more political power, and that is good. You did a good job, he would say, letting people who have the ability to do so live wherever they want to live, go wherever they want to go in this great country. You did a good job, he would say, elevating people of color into the ranks of the United States Armed Forces to the very top, or into the very top of our government. You did a very good job, he would say. He would say, you did a good job creating a black middle class of people who really are doing well, and the middle class is growing more among African Americans than among non-African Americans. You did a good job. You did a good job in opening opportunity. But he would say, I did not live and die to to see the American family destroyed. I did not live and die to see 13-year-old boys get automatic weapons and gun down 9-year-olds just for the kick of it. I did not live and die to see young people destroy their own lives with drugs and then build fortunes destroying the lives of others. That is not what I came here to do. I fought for freedom, he would say, but not for the freedom of people to kill each other with reckless abandon. Not for the freedom of children to have children and the fathers of the children walk away from them and abandon them as if they don't amount to anything. I fought for people to have the right to work, but not to have whole communities and people abandoned. This is not what I lived and died for. My fellow Americans, he would say, I fought to stop white people from being so filled with hate that they would wreak violence on black people. I did not fight for the right of black people to murder other black people with reckless abandon.
It's President Clinton, and that recording is included on the new box set of presidential recordings the Library of Congress presents, Historic Presidential Speeches, 1908 to 1993. My guests are the two co-producers of this box set, both from the Library of Congress, Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham. What do you find effective about the excerpt that we just heard?
I think the setting itself is significant. It's in the South. I couldn't prove this now, but I think his Southern accent is a little more pronounced than it is on a normal news conference, a televised news conference. And also, of course, he is in a church, and I think he, you know, President Clinton spent a lot of time going to church in the South, and I think there's a rhetorical style sermon style reflected in this speech. I think he's very comfortable giving this speech. It's a accepting audience. This was not going to be a major address. This was for a group that he felt very comfortable with. I sort of erroneously called it intimate. It's not so much that it's a one-on-one style of speaking. It's obviously a very rhetorically flamboyant speech, but he's very comfortable, and I think he feels that the audience is very accepting of him while giving the speech.
Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress recorded last November after the release of a CD box set they produced called The Library of Congress Presents Historic Presidential Speeches on Rhino Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the story of a singer who found his voice by impersonating Tom Jones. And film critic Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews She's the One.
It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. It's not unusual to have fun with anyone. But when I see you hanging about with anyone, it's not unusual to see me cry. It's not unusual to go out at any time. But when I see you out and about, it's such a crime. If you should ever want to be loved by anyone, it's not unusual, it happens every day.
No matter what you say, you'll find it happens all the time. Love will never do what you want to do. Why can't this crazy love be mine? It's not unusual, you want to be mad.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of the guests we have on Fresh Air are famous or about to be more widely known, but most musicians and artists never become famous. We're going to hear about one of them. This is a story which was originally heard on This American Life, a new national radio program from WBEZ in Chicago. It was produced by award-winning public radio producer Jay Allison with Dan Gettiman. Dan is the one who narrates the story.
That's not Tom Jones. It's my brother, Alex Jones. And that's not his real name. His real name is Mark Gettiman.
No, my real last name is Gettiman. G-E-D as in David, I-M-A-N. You know, I'm proud of the name, but as far as showbiz is concerned, it can't be spelt.
My brother's middle name is Alex. He bumped it up to the front.
I like Alex. Alex has worked. There aren't too many Alexes that are big these days, so I'm sticking with that name. It's very catchy. Just people always remember Alex.
For a while, when he was in this rock band in the late 70s, he called himself Alex Space, but that's another story. For the past 5 years, it's been Jones. Alex Jones.
I had a Jones for singing. I had an addiction. Yes.
That's pretty much the truth. My brother has had a Jones for singing for just about as long as he's been alive. All he ever wanted to do was make music, to sing for people.
The Kiwanis Group, the Knights of Columbus, the Lions Club, the Elks, the Sons of Italy. You name it. If there's one of those, I've been there.
My brother sang constantly in our house when we were growing up. He always wanted to be a rock star or the next great soul singer. Once he was out on his own, he sang everywhere he could, and he still does. Anywhere he can find an audience to appreciate him.
Jerry Lewis Telethon. I've done schools. I've done colleges. I've done arts exhibition and whatever. They also have cows and things like that. You know, one of those. Basically, anybody that'll have me, you know. Tom gets around.
My brother's been in countless rock, blues, and R&B bands over the years, but these days he's mostly hired as a Tom Jones impersonator. He does that by night, though. During the day, he holds down a straight job.
And it's tough to tell people, your coworkers, I'm going to be Tom Jones, particularly when I've been trying for the last few years to develop an image of this. I've been working as a computer analyst and developing this image as this kind of conservative nerd type, and I've totally blown it.
Fall in love. I'm never gonna fall in love.
My brother performs with a review called the Hall of Fame Superstars. There's a Patsy Cline, an Elton John, Buddy Holly, Roy Orbison, and then my brother closes the show as Tom Jones.
Singing as Tom Jones is very similar to the way that I naturally sing. We have a lot in common. But I've gotten to the point where I'm hitting notes and doing things that are beyond the scope of what he did.
My brother is nothing if not confident, at least on the surface. He thinks positive and has an uncanny, almost overconfidence. It's an amazing quality, really, even unsettling. My brother's 43, not married, doesn't have kids. He's had a lot of girlfriends, but he doesn't have a steady one now. These days, he's living at home with my parents in Massachusetts.
Why don't we go into the music room?
All right.
For, you know, a little bit, get out of the way and...
Growing up, we had a room in the house we called the music room.
Now, it looks a whole lot different.
That's where my brother and I talked the last time I was home visiting.
There was a Scott amplifier.
Right in the corner here.
Yeah, and in the corner here was a very large professional turntable, which had come right from a radio station. And I forget what the brand of that one was.
Recocut.
Recocut, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was a, you know, top of the line.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a great room. Great atmosphere. It was a place where you could just kind of go in and play around and make believe you're the star.
Come on, baby. Let loopy loop. She's a humbug. Nothing she can do. She's my little baby, little Latin loopy loop.
This is a tape of my brother pretending to be a star, recorded on my family's old Grundig tape recorder back around 1966. My parents put a lot of insulation in the walls of the music room so my brother could really scream.
The entertainers who've really are memorable and who've, you know, stand the test of time, a great deal of them have tremendous screams. So I've always thought that screaming was essential to someone who, you know, not necessarily in the popular music idiom, but in the anything that had any kind of edge or soul to it, there's got to be a scream there somewhere. And the whole reason is the same reason. It's a expression of the most inner primal feelings.
This is the room where my brother began studying the great rhythm and blues singers, people like Al Green, Little Richard, Otis Redding, James Brown, and Tom Jones, who my brother thinks brings them all together.
Just at the beginning of What's New Pussycat, he goes, "What's?"
Right.
See, now that you're getting now right there with the "What's," you got James Brown, "Wow," you know,
right.
And then you got Wilson Pickett, "Wow," and then right. You got Ray Charles, "Oh," you know, and then you got, you know, they're all like, and you go, and hey, hey, what's? See, it's all, that's there, you know.
I remember the first time I ever saw my brother perform. My parents took me to see him at a high school variety show when I was still in elementary school.
Now, nobody knew that I could sing, but there was a song that I, there was a band, the Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and the first version of them with Al Cooper. And there was a song on there called "I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know," which is a real bluesy ballad. And I used to sing that over and over and over again in this music room. So I ended up singing it. And it was a real, it was my first real performance as me in front of a stage, you know, kind of being the, you know, the performer, like the Elvis or something. And I can remember having this kind of silky shirt on, and I probably had my ID bracelet hanging, and opened up my collar a little, and it was quite an experience, as I recall. And I think I did fairly well, but I still do. I really sold it out, you know, really started screaming there at the end.
I remember by the end of the number, your shirt was virtually half off or something. That was my recollection. I was very impressed. I'm sure it was the first time I ever saw you perform.
I don't even remember that you were there. Which
I was absolutely there.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely there. And I remember that very well. But mostly, of course, I remember you. I have a vivid memory of being on the playground behind my elementary school, trying to explain to the other kids that the night before my brother was this, you know, big star. and I imitated you singing the same song, which, of course, I had heard endlessly with you rehearsing it, and I still know the song. And I went out and bought the record, by the way, about 5 years ago, and I have it. Wow. And the only reason I know that album is because of you. Yeah. But I remember I was imitating you, complete with undoing my shirt. I felt like a celebrity, even though the other kids didn't know it, because my brother, he just did this thing, and so I was pretty impressed.
We're listening to Dan Gettleman's story about his brother, a Tom Jones impersonator. We'll return to the story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Dan Gettleman's story about his brother, a Tom Jones impersonator. The story is produced by Jay Allison with Dan Gettleman. Dan is the one who narrates the story.
If it's not clear by now, I idolized my brother. I used to sneak into his room when he wasn't home and look through his things, put on his clothes, smell his cologne. As a matter of fact, I still have a YMCA t-shirt that he used to wear when he was a counselor at Camp Beaver. It's full of holes, almost a rag, but I'd never let it go. And I've always followed his career in music, because I was sure, especially after high school, that he was going to make the big time. And he almost did. His close calls with fame were many.
They proceeded to tell us that they were going to put something like $500,000 behind the supergroup, and we were going to be the next Beatles or Monkees. And I think at the time I was 21, I believe. And I'm just sitting there going, wow. I made the big time. And he actually said to me, I think you're the next Bruce Springsteen. He at the time was an A&R representative for Atlantic Records, joining this band called Easy Action. They said, listen, we want 50% of you. And I said, forget it. I started a band right after that called Alex Space in the Orbit. We're going to take you to the top. I've moved to another band now called Flyer. And we had a band called Future City. That band was called Zippers Polite and the Ambassadors of Love.
Everybody's got to have some fun. Too much depression in everyone. Let's live tomorrow and forget about the sun tonight.
It came to the point where every record company thought that the other record company was going to sign me, and in effect I was going to be the next big thing. There were articles written saying that I was going to be the next Kiss and this and that. And Warner Brothers, they were going to have cartoons, and even we're talking about designing some sort of a video pinball game, real total marketing thing. And I was so excited. And we were a couple weeks away from signing the contract, and when the OPEC had an oil embargo, 1979, the price of plastic went up 400%, and that was the end of my shot right there just vanished before my eyes.
Seems like years since I touched you. If I don't reach you, think I'll come apart.
We ended up getting them to sign us up for a booking contract. And then one night they came up to us. Neither of these guys drank. They had ulcers and they both walked around drinking a glass of milk. I remember one day they both walked up to me with a glass of milk and they said, would you mind wearing an Elvis mask?
You and me, we could be lovers.
To make a long story short, the thing really kind of fell apart. At this point, I really got totally discouraged with the whole scene. And in fact, I remember just feeling like that what I really had inside me wasn't coming out. I took this microphone, I still have it to this day, and I threw it up against the wall. I don't know. It's all smashed in. I just left and never went back. I left everything I had that was related to music in that room and just basically quit.
My brother left music completely for many years after this time, around 1984. For a while, he dabbled with a little home recording setup, trying to write some songs. but his heart wasn't in it. He stopped going out to clubs, lost touch with most of his musician friends, didn't play, didn't perform, just left. Then, in 1991, 7 years later, he discovered karaoke.
I was sitting having dinner, and I heard this music in the lounge, and this chorus of women singing was beautiful. I said, I have to go in and hear this group. And I went in there, and there's no group. There's a guy, looks like he's sitting behind a keyboard, and he's got this big thing saying, "You are the star, you know, sing the hits," or something like that. And I'm looking up, and there's a video playing of, like, kind of follow the bouncing ball. I didn't know anything about karaoke. And it just sounds fantastic. And I'm saying, geez, all these years, I've been sitting around, like, trying to, like, wait for the drummer to show up, or the, you know, the bass player's having a nervous breakdown. And here, you know, there's no band. They have these laser discs. They play the music, and you just go up and sing. Not only that, you don't even have to remember the words, because they're showing you the words. They had a little monitor that faces up to you. I mean, this was a singer's delight. It was heaven.
After that, he was hooked.
At the height of my interest in karaoke, easily I was going out all 7 nights.
People loved him. He'd steal the show, knocking out the audience at bars all over the Boston area. And he began winning contests.
All right, we have our, just take it, all right, just leave it right there. We have our five finalists standing over by the video monitor. And Billy Costa, all four judges have assembled and decided who the winner is going to be. Why don't you tell us who that is?
Wait a minute. Oh, okay, I'll just do it through this. I think it was unanimous. The guy was spectacular. Alex Jones. I think it was...
Alex Jones!
My brother had found his way back to music, but this time he was Tom Jones.
I feel authentic. I feel real. This is real.
So, where are you at in your process here?
Well, I like to put the leather pants on because it just feels good. But I forgot one thing. I got to put something in my pouch. The ladies love this. Roll it up so it's just about that thick. Right. And then you fold it over, okay? Uh-huh. And what you got there is a real peach.
So now you're going to stuff this down the front of your leather pants.
Absolutely.
And this is for the...
authenticity's sake. Next thing I do is I put a couple of belts with lots of metal on them. Because I just feel good. It also keeps my pants up. Okay, now, I have to get the makeup on.
Okay, can I follow you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I don't have the ruffle shirts. They're all at the cleaners. And I don't have time to pick up another. So, that's the best I can do. It's kind of got that look a bit. See? That's what I have under. But over, as I'll show you later, okay. I have a nice sequined tux that I put over all of this. And I kind of take a couple things off.
I see. Okay.
Because I get real hot. You know what I mean? Okay. Got to have rings and... bangles and bungles. I got the big cross, because he always had the big cross.
So
now, what I have to do first is tie up my own hair. Oh, I forgot. Also got to put the mascara on the chest hair.
When he was done, my brother was transformed. Not exactly Tom Jones, but close enough and ready to go.
5 minutes late ain't no problem when Tom Jones is in the house.
My brother and I go to a gig outside Boston where some company's holding its employee appreciation party.
Any pussycats out there? Do I hear any meows?
It's in a function room next to a hotel restaurant, Bumbershoots, Rockinghams or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Meow, yes. Pussycat, pussycat. I got flowers, lots of hours to spend with you. Get rid of him, so darling.
The night before this, my brother told me, he'd performed at a Chinese restaurant. And after his finale, the whole place, all the guests and the waiters, even the stagehands, they all stood up and gave him a standing ovation. He said it was like being in a movie. A few months after I interviewed him, my brother got laid off from his computer job. My parents told me they were pretty worried about him. Now he's playing the stock market, trying to parlay his retirement money into a nest egg that will carry him for a while until he makes it big with his Tom Jones act. While my brother performed, I circulated through the room, talking to people.
And this guy is just like him. He's very good. He's very good.
He was pretty close.
I thought he was very close. If I didn't meet him in the hallway and know otherwise, I would have questioned, was this really the Tom Jones?
I didn't tell anyone that Alex Jones was my brother. I just asked them what they thought of him.
He's got a great voice, really great voice. He does. He's good.
So how do you get him anyway?
I can make sure that you get his card.
Yeah, I would. I'd like to have his card.
I wanted to hear that he was making them happy. I wanted him to succeed. I wanted to help him get more work. I wanted to hear that they loved him.
Dan Gittiman's story about his brother was produced by Jay Allison with consulting producer Christina Egloff. It comes from Jay's ongoing series Life Stories, which is produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. It was originally heard on the new national radio program This American Life from WBEZ in Chicago, which we will continue to showcase on Fresh Air. Coming up, we have a review of the new film She's the One. This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Edward Burns made his first movie, The Brothers McMullen, on a budget of $30,000. His second feature, She's the One, which opens today, cost 100 times that. But reviewer Lisa Schwartzbaum says more gets you less in this romantic comedy about the love lives of a couple of clueless brothers.
Two movies is not enough of a track record to judge a young filmmaker, but it's a pretty good barometer of how a guy thinks. A year ago, Ed Burns became a film festival celebrity for The Brothers McMullen, his laconic and ingratiating study of three beer-drinking Irish Catholic brothers and the women who totally flummox them. It was a little Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus production, slight and gangly, but it worked to the extent that it did because the actors were unabashedly, earnestly amateur, and the whole thing was made on the cheap, always an appealing bottom line to studio executives. So Hollywood promptly snapped Burns up as a talent to nurture. Now I've got to wonder whether those studio execs pushed the filmmaker too far and too fast. because here she's the one, and it's nothing more than the further adventures of the brothers McMullen. Actually, it's less. This time, there are two brothers, Mickey Fitzpatrick, played by Burns, and Francis, played by Mike McGlone. And the movie budget is bigger, which means that while Burns has reinstalled himself, his real-life girlfriend Maxine Bonds, and his McMullen buddy McGlone in the story, he's also able to add marquee value stars Jennifer Aniston, John Mahoney, and Cameron Diaz to the cast. But in the spotlight, all of Burns' weaknesses are magnified. His trouble constructing natural dialogue, his directorial indulgence that keeps him from telling his nearest and dearest, "No, hon, you really shouldn't be in this one." And particularly his glaring inability to depict believable women characters who aren't either romanticized or ridiculed. In She's the One, people talk a lot about sex. A lot. But I swear not a sentence sounds like something a real man would say, either to a real woman or to his own brother or father. There's an extended marital discussion of vibrators that's embarrassing in its wrongheadedness, another about faking orgasms, and one about whether a man who wears cologne is ipso facto gay. There's a boorish exchange along the lines of how often are you getting some, and then there's this, in which Aniston, as the hungry wife of Francis, the obnoxious stockbroker brother, has a breezy conversation with her parents and sister about her husband's lack of interest.
Your mother told me you're still giving you that down cycle nonsense. 32 years your mother and I have been married. I don't think we've hit a down day, let alone a down cycle.
All right, great. Mom, we just make him go away, please?
Yeah, really, that is disgusting.
What's disgusting? That's true love, young lady.
Please. Spare us.
All right, I'm going to spare you. I'm leaving. I know when I'm not wanted.
Good, thank you. And hello, can we please not talk about my sex life anymore? Is that possible, please?
Yes, thank you. Can we please not talk about it in quite so icky a way? A lot of TV viewers have been waiting to see how primetime star Aniston would do on her first movie outing away from the cast of Friends. In fact, she does fine, or as fine as she can, working with a flailing McGlone and a completely out-of-her-depth director's girlfriend. John Mahoney from TV's Frasier is always sturdy. Too bad he spends all his time here giving oddball advice and calling his sons girls. But perhaps the most insulting fall in this sophomore stumble is taken by the character played by former model Cameron Diaz. Diaz plays a blonde cipher called Heather, a swanky businesswoman who's Mickey's ex-fiancée and who is now conducting a secret affair with Francis. I don't know why Burns takes pains to point out that Heather put herself through college as a call girl. The detail has nothing to do with the part. But I do know that it's hostile, and it sits there, emblematic of everything muddled and in need of guidance in the filmmaker's promising career. Burns is still one to watch, but in She's the One, no one's the one for anybody.
Lisa Schwartzbaum is writer-at-large for Entertainment Weekly.
Some days are diamonds. Some days are rocks. Some doors are open. Some roads are blocked. Sundowns are golden.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Cause you got a heart so big, it could crush this town, and I can't hold out forever. Even walls fall down, and all around your island there's a barricade. It keeps out the danger.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a series on the mind and body with Andrew Weil. He advocates incorporating alternative forms of medicine into standard treatment. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.